Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
So I said, hey, can you send this off to the FBI, the JRIC, the Joint Regional Intelligence Center, and see if they can get this translated and let us know if this is something we need to be concerned about. And so he takes it and I give it to him. And it's a couple of days later, I'm like, hey, have you got anything back yet? He goes, no, let me call him and see what's going on. So he finds out, they call him, and they say, yeah, it's a snippet from an ISIL website, and it roughly translated, it says, danger, danger, beware, beware. So I'm like, okay, maybe, you know, but they say, it's nothing to be worried about. Don't worry about it. So like, all right. So I said, hey,
Hoyt's famous last words, right?
Yeah. So I said, hey, send one of our TLO officers down there, have them take a report. And so we can just document the fact that, and what we did on this and stuff like that. So flash forward several days. I can't remember exactly how many days it is, but we would host, some Chinese police officers. Usually about 30 of them would come to our station, and we'd tell them about, you know, policing in, you know, the United States and San Bernardino and stuff like that. So we're in that, and we're on a break, and I go walking down to my office, and I'm sitting in my office doing something, and one of my captains walks in. He says, hey, there's some shots heard down in the south side of the city. Now, when I say that San Bernardino earlier is a very busy city, there is the south end of the city, which is like our commercial area, and it's nicer, and you really don't ever have any homicides or shootings or anything like that down there. So it's kind of odd that we're having any shots heard down there. And I'm like, okay, you know, shootings aren't new, but that's kind of an area that, you know, doesn't happen. But it didn't really raise any alarms, you know. And then literally a minute later, I'm walking down the hallway, and the watch commander comes over the intercom and says, hey, we have an active shooter down at the IRC. Well, of course, that's not something that we hear every day. So I grabbed that captain and I said, hey, let's go down and let's see what's going on. And as I'm driving down there, I'm thinking, wait a minute, this is where we had that phone call or that voicemail message from earlier. And I'm like, crap. And I'm calling the sergeant and say, hey, what did we find out when the officer went down there? And he's like, I don't know. Let me find out. So we get down there and I'm thinking, man, I hope I cross all the T's and dotted all the I's on this and that we did everything that we were supposed to. And I get down there. We get down there relatively quickly. And I don't hear any shots being fired. There's very few officers down there still yet. Our chief is in the a meeting at City Hall. We can't get a hold of him, and we leave some voicemail messages. And we get down there, and I go walking around to the back of the building. It's a large complex, and it was always a big building. We didn't really know what it was, but we thought it was some kind of governmental facility. And basically what the IRC is, it's called the Inland Regional Center, and it's a nonprofit. And what they do is they take care of kids who have developmentally disabled. So their parents come there, they give them training on how to help their kids and stuff like that. So that's what kind of facility it is. And I didn't know that until later. But we get down there, I walk around to the back, and I see our homicide sergeant back there. And I see a couple people laying there that have been, you know, wounded and stuff like that. And I walk in to the room, and the alarms are going off. You know, obviously it's the actual crime scene. And I come walking out, and, you know, to be honest with you, I'd been to so many homicide scenes that, yes, this was a large number, but at the end of the day, it's just a homicide scene in my mind. And we're trying to secure the scene. We've got people already searching the building to see what's going on, where the suspects are, if they're still there. And we obviously didn't know that. But honestly, it didn't, nothing to get excited about. Honestly, our cops knew what to do because they've been to, you know, some of them hundreds of homicide scenes. It's just a larger number of victims. Mm-hmm. And so that's going on. And then I finally get a hold of the sergeant and I say, hey, what happened? He goes, well, then the officer showed up. He says, hey, I played phone tag with that lady. I never got the report taken. So I was like, crap, you know, we didn't, hopefully we didn't miss something on this. Well, as much as I was crapping, the people down at JRIC that, that actually had the information that we gave them and processed it, you know, I think they had diarrhea down there because they're wondering if they had done everything they were supposed to. And so at that time, they started working out, talked to some people down there after the fact, and they said they started working it big time. And what I was told later was it had no connection to the IRC. It was coincidental, and it was one of the kids, an autistic kid that goes there, that actually left the recording. So no connection. But obviously, it's kind of coincidental that...
Coincidental. I mean, yeah, because you know that'll spin conspiracy theorists out, say, oh, no, you got warning of it. You were told about it. You guys ignored it. But it's like...
And that's not well known. I mean, I've spoken all over the country about the incident, and I briefed different police departments on that. But that's not something that's very well known, that phone call came in. Or not that phone call, but phone call with the recording. And but that did happen. But I was told after the fact.
Well, and we're kind of fast forwarding, but did they get even though he's autistic, did they get a chance to interview
the kid? That was something that the FBI followed up on, and not us. And they assured us it was not connected to the actual shooting.
Well, let's go back and talk about this, because had you guys done much active shooter training at that point?
It was something that, and I had participated as both the instructor at some points, this to a limited extent, but also I'd gone through active shooter training. So we'd actually trained on that quite a few times. I mean, they would gone through it pretty regularly. It'd become something that, you know, I remember I was a cop when Columbine happened, and, you know, from that, obviously the genesis to how we evolved and how we responded to those types of events. And we were pretty well versed on, you know, instructing our officers on what to do on an active shooter incident.
But in this event, though, by the time you got down there, the shooting was over, right? I mean, by the time the first cops got on scene, the shooting was done, the suspects were gone?
Yeah, so when the officers got there, that unbeknownst to them, the suspects had already left. And but the suspects had driven by while the officers were there. So basically what happened is that there's a lot, you know, I have a lot of, you know, information about how it all transpired, but the suspect himself, the male, he had wanted to commit a mass murder for several years, and he had, you know, radicalized himself over a number of years. He had had another friend that he had himself radicalized, and they had wanted to do a terrorist attack. They had actually had a bunch of different scenarios that they wanted to do. At one point, they wanted to shoot somebody on the 91 freeway, which is a very, very busy freeway between the Inland Empire and Orange County, create a traffic jam, which they didn't need to do that anyway. There's just nonstop traffic, and then walk amongst the cars that are stuck in traffic and execute people as they're walking down.
And that, we won't name the gentleman, but that the one you're talking about has the Hispanic name, correct?
Yes, yes. And so that never happened. And then they had an idea to go into to place some bombs inside of a community college and then explode those bombs remotely. And then as people ran out, that they would shoot the people. Well, what happened is that there was I can't remember at the moment the name of the operation, but the FBI had taken down some people in the Inland Empire that were planning to go, I think, to Afghanistan. They were radicalized, and the FBI took them down and arrested them all, and it was in our region. And so it spooked these guys. And so they decided, hey, we better go underground for a little while, and hopefully the FBI is not on to us. But they hadn't had a profile online at all. So, and over that time, the other person that you mentioned kind of drifted away and decided he didn't want to be involved in that. But the main suspect still wanted to. So he had met online this woman who was living in Saudi Arabia. And she's of Pakistani descent as well. She was radicalized, and that was what kind of an attraction for him to her. And then he traveled over there, and he brought her back as basically a 90-day fiance. And I don't know if, you know, no one knows if they had decided at that time to do a terrorist attack, or they planned to do it after they got married and came over here, and when the evolution of when that planning took place to do that. But they came over here, and you know, they had actually had a kid, had a couple months old by the time of the terrorist attack. And what's odd is that, you know, he's from here. He's an American. His parents are naturalized citizens. But he actually worked for the county. And his coworkers that hosted baby shower for him and his wife not too long before this incident happened. You know, so he didn't have a bad relationship with his coworkers.
How far into the incident did you get the identities of the suspects?
It was a good, well, what's interesting is that early on we had a name. And the interesting thing is that both suspects were wearing clothes that that kind of concealed their identity. But one of the victims who was wounded or not, I can't remember specifically, was talking to the investigators. And he says, you know what? He says, I can't say for certainty, but I think one of the shooters is our coworker, and he named him. And he goes, but I can't say with certainty because his face was covered. And they say, why do you say that? He says, well, because when he walked in, the way he carried himself, I could tell it was him. And he said that, and at first I thought that maybe it was some sort of active shooter training. And I thought, how stupid is this to do it here without telling us that we're going to do it? And how, what bad form to use the only employee that's a Muslim as the role player. And, so they thought it was, and then he said, obviously, then when the shooting started taking place and he knew it wasn't a drill, that that it was actually a real event.
You know, you brought up something that's interesting and that's been done before. A lot of people don't realize you're almost as identifiable from the way you walk as from your facial features. People mm-hmm. can look at your gait, you know, the way you do things, your mannerisms, and say, yeah, if you watch Tom Brady walk or Aaron Rodgers walk, you know, you could mask them, but you could say by the way they walked, you know who they are. I mean, obviously right. some famous stuff. And so that was interesting, is that they attempted to conceal their identities, but they were still identified.
And the second suspect, who was his wife, was initially identified as another male, by witnesses and stuff like that. They didn't know it was a female, but you know, we had that name early on. The problem is that the suspect had, I think, three or four brothers, and his dad, they all had the same names. They might have, it's almost like the George Foreman thing, where they had George Foreman 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. So mm-hmm. kind of had that. So, and one of his brothers in particular was in the U.S. military, but also had been a subject of an investigation by the FBI or something for some suspicious activity. So they're obviously focusing on some of that, trying to track him down. And so they're working through who are all these people, where are they at, where are they located, and trying to track that down. But they had those names relatively early, at least for one of the suspects.
So what's the response like once you start doing this? I mean, this is like, are you calling people in from days off or the next shift in early? You know, what's the response like from the city standpoint?
You know, from the city standpoint, you know, most of our officers, a lot of the officers working at that time, especially, you know, we have maybe 40 detectives working. So everybody heads down there because, you know, it's all hands on deck. But that being said, we're a very big city, very busy city. So there's a lot of things, even other shootings. You know, during the middle of this, we had another homicide that happened in the city unrelated to this. So there's other things that we have to take care of in the city. So while we're having officers call in, and they're saying, hey, do I need to come in? Do I need to come in and help out? We're like, no, you work swing shift. Come in at swing shift because we're going to need you to work swing shift, you know, and we still have a city to police outside of this. And so, you know, and there's some people that just came in and then, you know, just kind of reassigned them and did whatever we needed to do. But the city response, you know, we managed that pretty well. A lot of people have accustomed to being a busy city, and some people are calling the watch commander. But for the most part, those people that weren't at work that were scheduled to come in later, we told them, come in at your next shift. But it turned from a 4-day work week for people to a 7-day work week, but they were working their regular shift. Mm-hmm. But the response from other agencies, we never officially, not even once, requested mutual aid. You know, the interesting thing about San Bernardino is that we're so busy that all the cities on our periphery listen to our radio traffic. Because if we have a shooting or a robbery, the suspects might be heading out of their
chances are, yeah, they're going to be crossing into the jurisdiction. Yep.
So they listen to what's going on. So they all just proactively responded themselves.
Which goes back to what we were talking about with the Dorner shooting. The stuff there is that you got these people showing up from all over the place. Command and control, you know, coordination becomes a huge issue. But But this is going on, and so now you're starting to get a name. What starts happening? When do things like the federal agencies, like FBI or ATF, when does this start becoming involved? Because you know we're obviously people who know about this. This does end up in a shootout. It does end up, you know, you do end up identifying them. But how's the process of getting to that point?
You know, we called the officer that was assigned to take the initial report that I talked about, the phone call. He worked a lot with the FBI and, you know, doing some different terrorist stuff. So he made a phone call very, very quickly to the LA office, which is really, if there's no traffic, it's less than an hour drive or maybe about an hour from West LA to San Bernardino. And the FBI said it was the soonest they've ever received a call from a local jurisdiction. And they responded out right away to San Bernardino. And they came out with quite a bit of resources. I think they had two of their SWAT teams respond. At one time, we probably had about, from various jurisdictions, probably about six or seven SWAT teams on site at the location. Wow. Now, when I say that, you talk about the overwhelming response, not only did I see people from our local agencies, there are people from agencies an hour's drive away that just showed up. And what's funny is I'm in uniform that day, and I wear three stars, and I see these people coming up, and we're trying to get control and set up a perimeter. But everybody that's responding, of course, what do you think they want to do? They're going to get inside the building. They're going to go, you know, kill the suspects. And they don't want to set up the perimeter. That's not what their role is. But really, because our officers were the first ones there, they were the ones that got sucked in the building to do the searches very quickly. And we really needed to rely on the other agencies responding to secure the perimeter. The perimeter was so big that it took about 60 officers alone to secure it adequately.
Yeah, but you know, at the end of the day, though, too, it's kind of like guys, that's foolish to think that you're from another agency. You've got no jurisdiction here other than, you know, mutual aid. You think San Bernardino is going to allow you to come into the building and be the primaries, you know, on this stuff? It's almost like that's one of the good things, but bad things about cops. Right. Everybody wants to be involved in the action, which, you know, too, it's not just the action, but securing the perimeter, defending mm-hmm. people. You don't want to have a... Here's the importance of securing the perimeter. The two fucking suspects drove by while this shit was going on. How do we know that they didn't have a plan to say, hey, let's lean a semi-automatic out the window or toss a couple pipe bombs and start taking out cops who don't suspect this to happen?
Well, we know later through the course of the investigation, following their cell phone tracking, that they actually drove by the perimeter on numerous occasions. And we hypothesized that they, you know, didn't get that point yet, but they had left an explosive device inside that room, and mm-hmm. it didn't detonate. And it turned out they didn't, you know, wire it correctly. But we suspect that they were driving by to try to get in enough close proximity where they could detonate the device, you know, on the officers inside.
Holy cow. I read one article. There were as many as 300 officers responded.
There were probably at least 300. And they had...
Which is bigger than your department, right?
Yeah. And there was agencies I'd never heard of, assets that showed up that it's great to have everything because you never know what you're going to need, right? But I even got pulled aside by one person in an unmarked van and in civilian clothes that says, hey, I've got a predator overhead if you need to have any video.
Hey, that either sounds like Delta, DevGru, or not the agency. Agency's not supposed to be operating on U.S. Right. soil, but you never know.
But I didn't ask him where he was from, and I said, okay, I'll get back to you because I'm running around doing all kinds of stuff. But yeah, there are all kinds of assets.
Did you ask him if the Predator had a Hellfire missile attached to it as well?
Is it armed?
So we had a ton of people, and you know, and. The interesting thing about this is an active shooter event, historically, as you guys well know, at an active shooter event, the suspects usually stay there and they engage law enforcement. And it's almost like a murder-suicide type thing that they expect to engage the police and be killed potentially. But the suspects were gone and we're like, well, geez, they're gone. Where did they go? And what's going on?
Going back to the gang conference real quick, we had the chance to meet the two Nashville officers who took out the active shooter. Mm-hmm. At that school shooting, and it was the Covenant School, and it's like, yeah, that's what they did. The shooter took out the folks, was waiting around, and got engaged by law enforcement.
Right.
It's a little strange to show up to an active shooter, and there's no active shooter anymore.
Right, and that was obviously we're doing the due diligence and going through room by room to search the officers are searching the buildings, and very quickly we realized that more than likely they were gone altogether, and so at some point we gathered up all of our resources. And that's one thing you like to have. It was bad in the sense that it was an uncontrolled response. But at that point, we're like, hey, we don't know why this was the focus of the attack. We don't know if they're going to go somewhere else, but let's start deploying people to areas that we think that they might go to next. So we basically started assigning people to the courts, to the schools, and sending officers out to everywhere that we could think of that the suspects might go to next. And during that time, we started getting reports of other active shooters. So we have a large Amazon location next to our airport where they have a huge million square feet Amazon distribution centers. And we got a call that there was an active shooter at the Amazon distribution center. So we're thinking, crap, they went over there. And then we got a call that was somewhere else that there was another active shooter. So we started getting these calls that there were other active shooter events in our city taking place. And obviously your first instinct, your first thought is it's these people who have now gone somewhere else. So we deploy all these assets all over the city and some other government buildings and stuff like that.
Was that just hysteria? Was it just, hey, well, you know, there's an active shooter. We think we got one here. Was the news getting out by that time, or what accounted for these people reporting? It's rare to get an active shooter call, but to get two or three in the same day, it's almost like impossible.
Yeah, I think it was a little bit of hysteria. People, hearing something, seeing something, and all of a sudden getting kind of, excited and calling and saying, hey, I think something's going on over here. And we got at least two of those types of calls. And obviously that caused us to have to think we got to deploy people in case this actually takes place.
But as we come to find out, right, there was nothing to those other calls.
No, they were
right?
Totally unfounded. Yep. But then we started looking back over, days later, and we started getting where we'd had reports of males that fit the profile of terrorists that were actually, people thought they were scouting the mall several days before the attack. So we had to follow up on some of those types of reports and stuff like that to see if they were valid. So this went on for like quite a while where, for over a week, we were following up on a lot of tips. Now we're going back over all the wee tips and looking at things that happened elsewhere to see if we had done everything that we needed to.
Well, let's talk about how this engagement comes about, because you're getting into this, you're a couple hours in and you got all sorts of people over the place, but eventually not only do you identify them, you end up locating. How does that happen? So now walk us through the remainder of this.
So part of it is that we did have information about where the suspect's names, at least the one male suspect. We still didn't know who the second suspect was, whether it was a male or female. We had, witnesses had said it was a male. So, but we got at least the one name.
Real quick on that question too, that's what I was reminding of. The female suspect, was she dressed in such a way to make it appear that she was a male, or was she dressed as female and people just couldn't discern that because of, obviously, you're getting shot at, you may not grab all the details.
She was dressed in the same manner that the other suspect was.
Okay.
So, like black BDUs with like some tactical equipment on and stuff like that. So, and they had hoods on that you couldn't see their faces. So, no way for at least people at that moment to, no one ever identified as a female. No one ever did. Matter of fact, the initial descriptions that we were going off of was either, two Hispanic or white males is what we initially received. So, going forward, there was a, I'm trying to remember a little bit about how this, I've done this presentation so many times, but it's been a few years. But so we had the name, and then we had some suspicious calls. So there was a call of the suspects drove around, like you mentioned, they drove all over the city. I have a presentation where we tracked them eventually. The FBI put it together off cell tower sites and stuff like that, where they drove all over the city. I mean, it's almost like they didn't know where to go or what to do. And they did track by the IRC on several occasions, which we suspect that they were trying to get close enough to detonate that bomb.
Were any of these other places you say they were driving by, any of those, the locations you thought they might go by, like a school or a courthouse or anything? Or was it
They drove through our downtown. Specifically, I don't know that anyone's gone back to see specifically what locations. Other than it tracks them through different streets. But they never stopped at any of those that I'm aware of and stuff like that. But so we had the name of the suspect, and then there was an analyst that worked in our asset forfeiture unit that took it upon herself to start going through some of these calls. And there was a suspicious vehicle call at a park, and it kind of matched the description of the suspect's vehicle that we had. And there was a license plate. And at the time, we had sent an officer out and to that park. But by the time the officer got there, that vehicle was gone, so there was never any contact. But there was a license plate. And I think that license plate came back to Enterprise Rent-A-Car. And so she's running it. And, you know, she at the time was dealing a lot with the rental car companies because a lot of drug dealers rent cars and stuff like that. So she had a good relationship. So she calls him up and she says, "Hey, I got this suspicious vehicle call. And can you tell me anything about, you know, who leased it and stuff like that?" Turned out it was rented by our suspect. And then she was able to get the address that he used for that. And then she passed it on to the sergeant in charge of the narcotics unit to follow up on. Well, at the time, even though we had the suspect's name and some information, all the locations, the addresses that were in the government databases, whether it's driver's license or whatnot, was for an old address. We didn't have a new address for him. And although they were going out and searching these places, they couldn't find him. But this was a new address. So I'm in the command post the entire time. I was the deputy incident commander. We didn't know any of this was taking place. So they weren't passing this information on to homicide. And although a lot of people think that it was a federal investigation because the feds came out, they eventually did become a federal investigation, but not for 3 days. We were the lead organization. We were the lead homicide investigations as an agency because it was a homicide investigation in our city. And we have, you know, that's what we do. We do a lot of those. And so this sergeant took that information and they decided to follow up on it. And they headed over there to Redlands where that address was. Well, at the same time, some of our homicide detectives got that information. I can't remember exactly how they got it. So they sent two of our homicide investigators over that location to see if there was a car over there or anything like that. So they show up over there in their Crown Victoria wearing their San Bernardino PD raid jackets and stuff. And as they drive up the location, driving towards them is the suspects. And they see him and they're like, "Holy crap, that's the suspects right there," or the suspect in the suspect vehicle.
And the suspects were driving?
Yeah. They didn't identify a female in that car at the time, but they knew that was the suspect vehicle because it had the right license plate.
I mean, so, but it was like wasn't it a big black like a GMC or an SUV or something?
Yep, SUV.
Ford Expedition.
Yep. So they have to get turned around to follow it. They get on the radio and we hear them. They say, "Hey, we found the suspect or the suspects. We got the vehicle," and they put it out over the radio. And we're like, "Awesome!" Because at this time it'd been hours. I mean, it'd been several hours since the incident happened, and we didn't know where these people were. And you know, obviously, as a police department, you feel the pressure of we need to find these people and you know make sure that this doesn't happen again. But by the time they get turned around to get behind the suspects, they lost them. And they come on the radio and say, "Hey, we've lost the suspects. We don't know where they're at and we can't find them." Unbeknownst to them, those homicide detectives, and unbeknownst to us in the command post, the narcotics unit had gotten there and they had, you know, 5-6 narcotics officers and unmarked cars. And they saw the suspects and picked up a rolling surveillance of the suspects. Unfortunately, they didn't get on the radio and tell anybody. And the reason why they said it is, well, we didn't want to get on the radio and maybe the suspects had a scanner and they'd know that we were following them. Well, they didn't pick up the cell phone either and call us and tell us. So, but in the meantime, the suspect gets on the freeway to head back in the direction of San Bernardino and they're surveilling them, doing like a rolling surveillance on the suspects. They flag down a sergeant from Redlands PD and tell him, "Hey, we're San Bernardino PD narcotics. You know, I'm sure you know about the shooting. We're following the suspects. We need you to make a traffic stop on them." So he's like,
"Oh my God, I'm sorry."
So this
isn't just ripping off a dope dealer who just did an eighth of an eight ball, a Coke or whatever.
Exactly. So he gets on his radio, alerts his dispatch, which we're not monitoring, you know, their dispatch because we got so much going on and we never do anyway. So even though Redlands is aware of it, we're not in the command post aware that now Redlands is going to make a traffic stop on this guy. So he finally gets caught up to the suspects as they get off the freeway in the city of San Bernardino, and they start heading northbound on Waterman Avenue, which is a kind of a major north-south thoroughfare in the city. And he eventually gets caught up to him, and he turns on his audio recording. So we have an actual audio, and I have it, the audio recording of what's going on. So he gets up there and starts following the suspects, and then he tries to pull them over, And they turn and stuff. And eventually he comes out and they start shooting. And it's the female. She's in the back seat. Starts shooting at him. So he's taking gunfire. Of course, he backs off. The suspects, I don't think they knew that there was probably about five or six other police cars around them, just unmarked, following them. And so eventually the suspects stop. He stops a distance behind them to create some distance so he's not taking, you know, fire very closely. And then the gun battle starts. It's just a huge gun battle. Our officers jump out. They start, you know, kind of maneuvering around to put gunfire on it. And the driver, who is the male suspect, gets out and starts walking across the street while he's engaging our officers. And he is killed probably about 30 seconds into this. He goes down in the street. He's wounded, shot multiple times, and he expires. But there's still someone who we believe that's alive in the back seat. And there's still a tremendous amount of gunfire towards that. You know, on the audio I have, you can hear the gunfire from the officers firing at the suspect's vehicle. And at some point, somebody says, "Are they still shooting at us?" And we don't know, but there's still more rounds going down range at the suspect's vehicle. Mm-hmm. We suspect, you know, I got the autopsy reports. That suspect in the back of the car was probably had 20 gunshot wounds that would have killed her within seconds, according to the coroner's report. And we suspect that she was dead relatively soon in this incident, the exchange of gunfire. But the actual police car was hit and stuff like that. But what happens, what's interesting enough, and I didn't cover that, is that there's another deputy that comes into the scene. He drives past that sergeant from Redlands PD and places himself between the suspects and that sergeant. And obviously, he's pinned down right away because he's in really close proximity to the suspects. And so that's, you know, he's obviously, you know, in danger and he's got to be rescued in this. But, you know, the craziness of it is that there was like, I think, 23 officers that fired rounds downrange and probably, I think, 500 to 600 rounds or more that went downrange that we could account for. And you'd have officers that, you know, during their interviews, I was 15 feet away from the suspects. And then we were able to, through the course of the investigation, place them 150 feet with a handgun shooting at the suspects. So, you know, a lot
only
of
on TV, can you sit back with a 2-inch sub nose 38 from 300 feet away and hit the suspect with the first shot?
Yeah. Wing them.
It worked out
wing
in them. Real life.
So it's pretty chaotic. And the thing is that there was a lot of stuff going on. So, it's kind of like the fog of war, so to speak. Because obviously there's a lot of civilians that don't know what's going on. And our officers are jumping through backyards to maneuver to get closer to the suspect's vehicle and stuff like that. So we're getting calls from people saying, "Hey, they're in my backyard. The suspect's in my backyard." And so we're constantly chasing these ghosts, which are actually police officers that are going through backyards and jumping over fences. Because we knew that one suspect had exited the vehicle. And now we're hearing through witnesses that there's a suspect fleeing on foot and they're in these backyards and stuff like that. And then also kind of a funny aside is that there's a deputy who's in close proximity to the events going on and he runs a license plate that comes back stolen. And he gets in a pursuit of a stolen vehicle blocks away. And then we got the air support and they see the lights and siren thinking that's the suspects. And they're following the stolen car pursuit thinking that's related to the terrorist attack. And so there's all this stuff going on around us that is taking place. And then our air support unit, the one thing that our sheriff's department does is they will actually engage suspects from the air with their weapons. So the funny thing is that I have this recording that the pilot on the aircraft says, "Hey, if I lose you, if you don't hear from me in a minute, it's because I'm having to fly the aircraft and talk on the radio because my co-pilot is transitioning back to the back seat with his M4. Because they'll actually get down low and use it as a shooting platform to take suspects out.
Wow. And you thought that only happened in the movies. No, folks, it happens in real life.
I love it.
Yeah.
I love
it. But I'll tell you what, that takes some skill because you're in a, you're in an aircraft moving, you know.
Yep.
Oh, my. So what were most of the we know that the terrorists, they're armed, as we know later, they're terrorists. They're armed with 223.
Yes.
Most cops were what, nines?
You know, there was a number of officers that did have M4s. But most officers just had their sidearms. There was, amazingly, there was some officers who fired off shotgun rounds. And so we have these police cars that are between the suspects and the, and these officers that, that were behind the vehicles, right? And I'm looking at these crime scene photos and I'm looking, hey, is that a shotgun wadding? Well, that's 30 feet behind the officer's vehicle. So, and, so it was kind of chaotic. You know, probably people that had fired that probably shouldn't have fired just because they weren't in a position to actually hit the target, quite honestly. But
you know, when you get in a shootout, whoever fires that first round, it's like an immediate reaction. Everybody starts yanking that trigger.
Well, what happened?
Like, it's like giving a standing ovation. Everybody looks around, but the first time somebody stands up, everybody's like, oh, yeah, mm-hmm. Well, I'm in. Yeah.
The officers engaged the suspect, and I should say suspect's vehicle, probably for about 5 or 6 minutes. And what would happen is you listen to the tape is that you would hear somebody shoot. And maybe they perceived that there was some movement in the vehicle. And then they would shoot. And then all of a sudden you hear pow, 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 pow. And then I'm going to start shooting again. And and then you'd have to get the sergeants trying to get control saying, cease fire, cease fire, cease fire. And I sent my one of my lieutenants, who's a good friend of mine, he'd been involved in several officer-involved shootings, pretty heroic stuff. And I sent him down there to kind of take control of that scene. And he told me later, he says, Eric, I've never been scared on any of my shootings that I've engaged in. He says, as much as I hear. And I said, he says, it's not because I thought I was going to get shot by the suspects, because I thought I was going to get shot by another cop. And lo and behold, some of the police cars that are facing the suspect that have open doors that the officers use as cover have gunshot impacts from the rear on the police cars.
Friendly fire.
Yeah.
Wow. That and crossfire. I mean, a lot of people don't, before you pull that trigger, what's on the other side of it? I mean, it's a circular firing squad.
Yep. I got to say that as many rounds that went down range, and there were people like pulled onto the side of the road in that neighborhood, kind of witnessing what was taking place. It was a residential neighborhood, kind of a wider street. But although we shot a stolen car because it's San Bernardino and we just have stolen cars randomly parked throughout the city, there was a stolen car shot, there was mailboxes shot, there were houses shot. Fortunately, there was no collateral damage or injuries to people, just objects. You know.
Holy cow.
But my understanding too was they had either was non-functioning or malfunctioning, but they had another explosive they tried to use out there, right? Or was that?
No, that was something that was bad info. They never had actually another device out there.
Okay.
There was something that was, I think someone saw it come off a vehicle or something and they suspected it might be an explosive device, but it turned out not to be.
And see, that's the problem too. You get these stories. That's why it's good to get somebody in here who knows about it, because people will run with it. We had Bill Sarukas on and Jeff Nye. Jeff Nye was Montgomery County. Bill Sarukas, U.S. Marshals, involved in the D.C. sniper. And what's one of the biggest things, the D.C. sniper? White panel van. Everybody started, you take a story, it starts blowing up, it's anchored in everybody's mind. And that's the thing here, is that's one thing we're trying to do is just drill down through this and just get to the meat of the matter, which is, you know, what's real, what's not. But I'm like you, I'm amazed with all the shots that went off, other than the initial shooting, the 14 victims, the 21 injured, that nobody was killed out at that scene with as much lead that was flying through the air.
And, you know, back to your point about the white panel van, we put out that the suspect's vehicle was this black SUV. And you don't realize how many black SUVs there are until one's involved in a mass murder. And there's one on every street corner. And of course, every officer in Southern California is making traffic stops on black SUVs, and it's taking place all over the place. But going back a little bit to, you talked about the explosive device. So going back to just before we found the suspects and engaged in that shooting with them, the SWAT teams had gone through. We had multiple SWAT teams that were going through, sweeping the building, clearing it out and stuff like that, making sure that the suspects weren't there. And they had recently come out and they're trying to make a decision. Do we need to turn it over to homicide? Because homicide actually hadn't initiated the investigation inside. And we're probably about 4-5 hours into this investigation, but it hadn't been made secure yet, so to speak. And there was a debate on whether they had done enough to clear that building out and turn it over to homicide. And then the officer involved shooting happened. And then as you know, when you talk about the self-initiated deployment to the initial scene, Now suddenly everybody that's on the perimeter, everybody that's engaged there, they know that the suspects are in that building. Now I think there's no more longer any importance for me to be here. So everyone's abandoning the perimeter. They're running out their police cars, but there's so many police cars that if you got there early on, your police cars, you know, kind of
you're
like
jammed up.
You're yeah. they're log jammed in there. So yeah. one thing that we knew is that, you know, we have one key that functions to operate all of our police cars. What we didn't realize sometimes is that some of those are keyed for other police departments too. So people would, you know, try the car that was the last in line, whether it was from their agency or not. Hey, this one works. I'm out of here. And they'd get jump in the car and take off and self-deploy over to the other scene and show up. So
speaking of a continuing rash of auto thefts happening.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, so it was kind of a chaotic scene. But once we that was done and secure, we said, hey, we need to go back in and recheck the interior. Someone said, hey, let's just go back in there and recheck this thing again. It wasn't until then that that original explosive device was found on the table.
Wow.
And you said they were driving by, so it sounds like they had some kind of a remote detonation trigger, like yeah, a cell phone or something similar.
The way they had it, talking to the guys that are experts on this stuff, is that they used a remote-controlled RC car as the device that would detonate it. So you use the remote control for the RC car to detonate it. Kind of unique about this, the guys kind of laughed, is that they never took the shell off the car. So you see in the backpack the actual car that's hooked up to the bomb, which are several pipe wow. bombs that are connected together. But he never took it off. But they said he kind of knew what he was doing. He just kind of missed a step.
Well, a couple of my buddies were with New Scotland Yard. They investigated the 7705 train bombings, and we had them on a prior episode. Alan Thomas and Graham Burridge, and everybody knows about that attack. They forget that there was a second follow-on attack mm-hmm. a couple weeks after that, and they were using hydrogen peroxide, TATP type of stuff. But yeah, those bombs didn't go off to the same point. They kind of knew what they were doing, but they got the triggers all wrong, and so it didn't detonate,
right?
Which was fortunate for everybody. But in this case, though, too, there's a couple things I want to talk about, because they tried covering their tracks. They tried destroying their electronics, their phones, and everything before the attack, tried to cover up some of their tracks. Is that right?
Yeah, they had gotten rid of, they'd totally gone offline. There wasn't much of anything. If you went online to search for them, emails or anything like that, they had pretty much gone through and done a pretty good job of eliminating their whole electronic footprint.
Well, but there was one aspect, and I actually opined about this on some national news shows, and I was actually out at the RSA conference, which is a big cybersecurity conference, when Loretta Lynch, who is the AG, was actually talking about this case. And one of the big issues was they had an iPhone 5, and Apple would not cooperate in unlocking the iPhone 5, even though at that time with those phones, they could have. Mm-hmm.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Are you a financial advisor considering the Independent Registered Investment Advisor, or RIA, model and wondering where to start? Start with Schwab Advisor Services. Schwab has helped thousands evaluate the full range of options and can help you determine your best path forward. Navigate the big and small decisions by tapping into Schwab's decades worth of insights on what fuels RIA success. With Schwab Advisor Services, you have a custodian that will support you every step of the way. Start your journey today at advisorservices.schwab.com/paths.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Yeah, what happened there?
They had gotten rid of their personal phones. To this day, we've never found them. And going back to where they were seen at that park, there's a lake there. it's a man-made lake that we have in the city. We fish bodies out of there occasionally. It's a lot of drug activity, so there's a lot of syringes. The FBI dive team, hey, my hat's off to them. They got in their dry suits and waded through there looking to see potentially if the suspects had gotten rid of their personal cell phones in there. Never found anything. But they had these, or there was this one iPhone, and it was the county-issued cell phone to the suspect. So it was part of his employment. And so we didn't think, I mean, he maintained it, didn't get rid of it, and it was the county phone. But you can't leave anything unchecked. So they say, hey, we've got to check this phone. So it's my understanding, and I've taken, at the FBI National Academy cyber class and stuff like that, it's my understanding that if Apple had wanted to cooperate, they push out those Apple updates to your phone, you can update it. They can do it to a single device. It's my understanding they could have sent out an update specifically to that phone to unlock it. But they stood fast on their privacy thing and saying, we're not going to do it and stuff like that. So the FBI found a vendor that could. So,
yeah, I believe it was a company my buddy worked for at that time, Cellebrite, over in the UK was one of the ones that, but they paid a lot of money to do it. Mm-hmm. But it gets back to the point. See, that was one of the discussions that I remember. I actually thought she made a good point, but it's like, we were at the point where we were allowing one single private company to determine national security policy. Mm-hmm. And so it's like, hey, I get it. You want privacy, but we're talking about a terrorist. I mean, I tell you what, here's my thought. Tim Cook was CEO at the time. Steve Jobs had passed away. I don't know if
second. I got housekeeping knocking on my door. Hold on one second.
Yeah. Police, search warrant, demand entry. Yeah.
They're gonna make my bed for me. That's why I didn't make it.
You know what the hell? We're not going to edit that out. That's fun. No. I was thinking, but I don't know if Steve Jobs would have done it, but Tim Cook didn't. But my thought was always, well, let's turn this around. Let's say that it's your kids who have been kidnapped or friends of yours, or your family members, and they've got an iPhone. And if you unlock it, you can find out where they're at. Would you do it? Would Tim Cook still say, no, we're not going to do it?
And the thing is that I think they were concerned that somehow they would give away some kind of proprietary, information about how their phones operate and the security features. So they kind of held fast. Well, although they could have done that thing without giving any of the technology away for the update.
The Bureau said, look, we'll bring it out there. You do what you need to do with the phone. Just unlock it. We don't even want to know how you do it. Just unlock the phone for us. We'll take it out to your facilities. They still said no. I just think, I know now it's gotten to the point, unless you've got the biometric or the password or whatever, it's just virtually impossible to unlock these phones anymore.
They, my daughter works at, I told you she works at the department, but she's our Cellebrite and Gray Key operator. I shouldn't say my, cause I'm retired, but so they buy keys and they cost more money, but as the phones and they update the security features, obviously they're always a one step ahead. But how quickly that the Cellebrite or Gray Key can, kind of figure it out. You can buy keys, so to speak, to unlock them. But it does. There is a little bit of a delay. Yeah,
and there's a little bit of a cost too. Those things
they're
don't
not
come cheap.
Yep.
They are not cheap.
But so, I tell you, after the company that broke that phone, Apple wanted to know who's the company and how'd they do it.
Sorry, you had your chance. We could have kept this from happening. Now we're not going to tell you how we did it. Hey, but that brings back to the question, because you said it was your investigation for 3 days. At what point did it become apparent to you that this was a terrorist attack, that all the indicators were there?
Yeah, so early on, we knew it was a terrorist attack, obviously. I mean, well, intuitively, I should say. I mean, we didn't have any obvious evidence that it was. There was no posting or anything that anybody had found and about it. And a funny story is that we are still the lead organization on it, but the FBI had flown out people from their crime lab and stuff like that. And they said, hey, do you mind, or we have our crime lab, we can offer you all of this technology. And although our local sheriffs have a very extensive, very good crime lab, some of the capabilities from the FBI exceeded what they had. Plus, they were going to process the entire scene. And it was a big scene, a big messy scene, so to speak, because you think about it, the number of people you've mentioned that were dead and wounded in there, the sprinklers had come on mixing with that stuff, and it was spreading all that everywhere. It was a very, very messy, messy scene. So we said, yeah, sure, come in. If you're going to provide all that assistance, it's just a mutual aid thing. But we are still the lead as far as the investigation goes. So the funny story about it, though, I was going to speak, is that we're getting ready. Everything that we did pretty regular press conferences, and we're in this meeting before we're going to go out and do another press conference. And we always had all of the lead agencies, us, the FBI, the Sheriff's Department, and, you know, David Bowditch, who was at the time, who later went on to advance in the FBI, was the lead there from the LA office. And then my chief and I was there, and then the sheriff. And we're watching the news, and the president comes out, Obama, and he says, the FBI is the lead in this investigation. And at that time, we were still a lead. So David Bowditch says, man, I can't tell him that the president's wrong. So he had to kind of think about how he was going to respond to that if he got asked directly by the media if the FBI was the lead. But we are still lead. So what happened is about 3 days in or thereabouts, the FBI finally found an email or like a profile online that the suspect had where he had actually pledged allegiance to al-Baghdadi. And from that, they were able to extrapolate that this is a direct connection to terrorism. And then they took it as a federal issue and took over the lead in the investigation.
You know, that's very interesting. We had a friend of mine, Ed Davis, was the commissioner of Boston Police when the Boston Marathon bombing happened. And same thing, issues there. They didn't want, if the FBI had taken over at that time, and as they found out and declared it a terrorist incident, many of the insurance coverages and all the other things that would pay out would not have been in effect. Because it would have, that was part of their force majeure. Hey, we'll do it except for terrorist attacks. So There was a lot of politicking and maneuvering involved with the FBI and Rich DeLaurier and the guys out there being involved in the Marathon bombing as well, simply because of those facts. The minute you come in and you say it's a FBI, once they say it's a terrorist thing, that changes legally the complexion, not only from a criminal standpoint, but insurance, civil damages, everything after that.
It's a mess.
Well, look, let's talk about the aftermath now. So at some point, like I said, the FBI comes in and takes over. When are you at the point to where you are satisfied that there are no more suspects, that there are no more follow-on attacks, anything else coming on?
You know, we were pretty confident after the suspects were located and taken out that was the only information that we had was that there were two suspects, and we knew we had two suspects dead at the scene. And speaking of that a little bit, you know, we actually used a Rook. It's looked like an armored Caterpillar, and it was from another agency that brought it in, which then went up to the car, opened the door, and actually reached in and pulled the second suspect out of the back seat and dropped it onto the ground outside, and then started manipulating the clothes, checking it for explosive devices. And it wasn't until that moment when they put over there, hey, this is a woman. Up to that point, we had no idea.
Hmm. Wow. But obviously you're consolidating this. The other word I had too, and I just wanted to check that with you too, it's like 12 of the people, the victims, they died at the scene, but two of them survived long enough, but to get to triage, and they died in triage later.
Nobody died at the hospital. Everybody that made it to the hospital survived. Everybody that died at the scene.
Right. Okay. And see, that's why I said you read some of this stuff and it's like, you know, we've always tell people do your own due diligence. And that's why it's great getting you on and other folks like you on who were there that know what's really going on. Because if you believe what's written out there about everything, as we found out, it's highly inaccurate. I mean, if somebody says something and somebody repeats it now and say, oh, look, I've got three people saying the same thing. It must be true. No, the first guy got it wrong. The other two just repeated what was wrong.
And maybe there's some confusion because, so we had the victims that were inside the building, the conference room at the IRC, and they had to get taken across the street to where we had the triage location for the victims. And that was across the street on the golf course. And so we had officers that, you know, carried them out of the building, put them in a vehicle, backseat of a car, and drove them across the street. So there were a couple people that were wounded that were taken to that triage location, but before they could be evacuated, they expired, they died. But everybody that made it to the hospital survived.
That's what I was getting at too. That's what I thought in terms of the triage. Some of the folks that did not make it out of triage, but everybody went to the hospital, survived, which is a testament to that golden hour. You got to get that care.
We got them out of there very, very quickly. They were landing helicopters right there on the fairway to medevac those folks out.
Nice. Man. In all your years, have you had an incident bigger than this?
No, that was the biggest. And, you know, at the time, we've had some terrorist attacks in the country that eclipsed that. But at the time that it happened, it was, by loss of life, the largest terrorist attack in the United States after 9/11.
Hmm. Which is not a good reputation to have.
No. It was eclipsed very shortly thereafter by the Pulse, which actually had more victims.
Down in Orlando,
but up to that
yeah.
point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yep.
And Sandy Hook.
And, you know, what's interesting is you always have wonder, you know, it's such a small world. And here I am looking at some pictures of the incident down on the Pulse. And I see this officer standing in the front that I actually was in the Marines with in front of the Pulse.
Wow.
So, yeah.
Small world.
Let's talk about after action, which the military is, you know, very fond of doing after action reports. What are some of the things that came out of this that actually helped make things better for a future response?
You know, there's something that has come up. You mentioned it in the Dorner incident. It happened in our incident, and it seems to happen again and again and again. It's the uncontrolled self-deployment of officers to these types of incidents. And the thing is that while, you know, they're supposed to check in on mutual aid, they're supposed to check in and get an assignment. People tend to self-deploy and take up their own assignment, and it's not necessarily things that we need to be done. And they do it on their own. And there is an element, to be honest, that we do need some of that. And, you know, we hire police officers that take the initiative to do things. You don't want them to have to stand there and wait to be given direction. But sometimes that's a little on steroids, and they overdo it. For example, I mean, I was in uniform, wearing three stars, and I'm trying to stop these people from other agencies to say, hey, I need you on the perimeter. And they kind of look at me. They don't work for me because I'm from a different department, and they just keep going past me because they want to get inside the building. But this is something that's repeated again and again. And, you know, it's often a discussion when I'd go around the country and speak about the incident, people would say, hey, how do you prevent this from happening? And, you know, it's a hard decision because it's like, do you praise people with their self initiative, but then you want to rein it in and discipline people if they don't do what you want them to do. And you have to find that balance a little bit. So that was a big takeaway. How do we fix that? How do we correct that self-deployment, over-deployment? Matter of fact, there was agencies where some of their officers were in our city shooting at the suspects, and their agencies didn't even know they were there.
Jeez.
And they're there from another county.
So. There should have been some massive ass chewings going on when all that was found out.
Yeah. Matter of fact, at the end, we're trying to determine all of the shooters. And one of the persons didn't even disclose initially that they had fired any rounds.
Why? Because they would have had to write reports?
Maybe. You know, the thing about going back to being a police officer on the streets for a lot of times, we've deployed mutual aid for other agencies and for small riots and stuff. And it's always like, hey, you get to go over there, kick ass and get it out of there before any paper's taken, right? So you go over there, shoot off your less lethal munitions on the rioters and take care of action. And hey, no one ever saw me, I'm out of here. And you don't have to write a report, right? Obviously today with cameras and stuff, that's probably hopefully taking place a lot less than it ever did in the past. But that's kind of like the mindset, I think, a lot of times of officers that, hey, it's not my city, I'm not responsible for writing the report, and they want to get out of there.
And I apologize for some background noise here real quick. My neighbor decided to start doing tree trimming right as we're doing this. But that kind of reminds me, too, of one of the reasons why we got the National Incident Management System after 9/11. We had to have a coordinated way for people to do this. It just seems to me as people want to get involved. And that's your point. You don't want to tamp that down. But at the same time, how do you get people to have the mission mindset, which said, look, everybody's got a particular role, a particular mission. If I'm coming in from an outside area, the biggest thing I can do is provide support. I'm not going to be tip of the spear because that's reserved for the agency whose responsibility it is. How do we change that with training? To your point, how do we not cut back on the warrior mindset, but at the same time, how do we make them part of an effective fighting unit, which is, as you know, hey, everybody, every Marine unit, every Army unit, whatever else, everybody's got a role. You got to do your role.
I think part of it is kind of like what we did with active shooter, where we did so much training where we drilled in that, hey, when you get there, don't wait for backup. And that's been the evolving training too, because it was originally get there, form a team, and make entry, right? But we're still waiting too long before we went in there. And the training's kind of evolved in active shooters that if you're the first person there, even if you're alone, make entry. and try to locate and take down the suspects. And you hear it a lot of times, some officers, well, I got to have a backup. Well, you know what? You get paid a lot of money for somebody that has a high school education. You knew the dangers of the job, and you knew that you're going to put in a position like that, and you accepted the position. So go forth and do your job. But I think it's going to come down to where, you know, this deployment issue, mutual aid becomes, and they do training, but not enough. That we agencies really drill it in to where, if you respond to another jurisdiction, make sure you get a point of contact with that other agency. Understand when you arrive what your role is in that, because your role is not going to be actively engaged in what's taking place. More than likely, it's going to be those secondary assignments like securing the perimeter, making sure that no evidence that it's on the ground escapes, or that the suspects, if there's still an active engagement, don't escape the perimeter.
Yeah. Back in 2012, I've told some other, I was the senior law enforcement advisor for the Republican National Convention down in Tampa, actually. But the role of the National Guard there, they say, why is the National Guard here? It was to offload the protection responsibilities for a lot of these areas we're operating out of so that the police could deploy to there. The National Guard had a very specific role. And that's why I think part of the training ought to be is like, yeah, you want people getting in there, but man, it's so hard to do that when shit's, when, you know, lead's flying or, you know, the smoke's blowing and the action is going on. I think cops instinctively want to get involved, but man, it's one of those things. It's like, yeah, but not everybody gets to be there at the tip of the spear to pull. Right. Everybody wants to take the bad guy or girl down, but sometimes that's just not your role that day.
Right. Absolutely. And that's the mindset. They want to, hey, there's a bad guy in there. We need to take him down. Maybe that's going to be me today. And that's the mindset.
Yeah. So I hate to be, because there's some folks out there who've won some awards for doing stuff. But sometimes you run into those people, right? To where it's like, why are you here? Well, I'm just here to help. And it's like in the back of your mind going, no, you're just here to get an award. You're just here to get a medal. You know, are you doing it? Are you doing it for yourself? Are you doing it for your buddies and for the good of the operation and the mission, what's going on?
Yeah, and I'll hit on that a little bit. You know, there's a lot of people that, you know, I did a lot of presentations on this incident along with the chief. I mean, I was flying all over the country. And I would talk about the things that didn't go right as much as the things that did. And because I think you learn more from the things that didn't go mm-hmm. right that you hope not to be repeated. And I said, you know, I would tell people, I said, everybody viewed what we did as a success, that we had a textbook response to this incident. But let me tell you what happened. But everybody views it as we had the textbook response, because at the end of the day, we located the suspects and they were taken out without any additional loss of life. But for all the mistakes that happened, if it didn't end up the way it did, people would have pointed at us saying, you guys did all these things wrong. And right. And to that point, we kind of reinforce that a little bit because of the response to what we did and how the end result, everybody in the agency that had any point in this or any touch of it as a hero, that we did an awards thing. And so a lot of these people who did things that they probably shouldn't have done, that they should have done differently, were all given awards, which kind of reinforced the things that they had done.
Yeah. And that's a tough thing to do. You want to recognize people for bravery and what they do, but it's like, well, let me reverse and ask the question this way. You had 300 people show up. How many people did you really need to get the job done that day? Did you need all 300?
We didn't need 300. The perimeter was large only because we didn't know, obviously, you know, in law enforcement, you always create the biggest, you know, perimeter that you can, because you don't know the extent. And then you kind of, after you get there and realize what it is, you condense it. Because you can't, it's more difficult to grow a crime scene perimeter than it is to reduce it. And we did take a number of, you know, quite honestly, more, it was just as important to keep the media out of the crime scene, because it was probably the largest media response that we'd ever seen. Probably 100 credentialed members of the media with cameras who are all trying to like crawl through a dry riverbed to get a better shot of the crime scene and stuff like that. So to some extent, the number of people securing the crime scene, which is about 60 in this big, large perimeter, was to keep the media out as much as it was to, you know, preserve the evidence. So initially we needed that many people, and but it got dialed in. I mean, when you really look at it, maybe 50 people have secured a perimeter. There was really only 10 people, 15 people that needed to go into the IRC building itself to secure it. Obviously, there was some fatigue. It was a commercial building that had steel reinforced door jams, which were very difficult to breach. You know, so it took a lot of time to breach those doors and get in and adequately search. But we didn't need necessarily 300. That was a little overkill. Absolutely.
Jeez.
Hey, kind of as we bring this to a close, let's just talk about why did you get any sense, or did the information, the intelligence tell you why they picked the particular target they did? I mean, they were obviously going to do something, but that day, was it just simply because of the shooter, the male's familiarity, because he was the county employee and knew that, or was there any reason this, I mean, by all accounts, these folks are like the least the least offensive people you're going to find out there. They're trying to work with people, you know, trying to help people out. It's like, what is it that these guys did that put them on the radar of these two pieces of shit?
You know, no one truly knows why they picked that particular day to do it. There's been a lot of speculation out there, and I've heard people talk about the triggers. So it was during the holiday season. And the IRC has this conference room that gets rented out virtually around the clock for different events during that time of the year. And what they had a Christmas tree in there. They had some holiday decorations and stuff like that. Because, you know, people would come in, they're hosting Christmas parties and using that little small conference center to do that. So there's some speculation by people that, well, they came in there and they had this this holiday stuff, and they're radicalized, and that triggered them, and they left and went their guns and came back and did it. But I think that it was just that for some reason they had it in their mind they were going to do this attack. That day was a day where they had a significant amount of people gathered there to that they had as an opportunity to do it, and that's why they did it. You know, it didn't go down the way they wanted. They stopped out because the suspects, or the male suspect, was there at the event. He left, went home, and got his wife. But before he went and got her, he left his backpack with the bomb on the table. When they showed up at the location of the vehicle, we believe, based on the statements of that other suspect that that didn't carry out a terrorist attack, that how they had planned to do an attack at that junior college, placing the bomb in the library and exploding it, and then shooting people coming out. We believe that they tried to detonate the bomb when they arrived, and then they were in place to shoot the people as they evacuated, but the bomb didn't detonate, so they had to make a hasty entry into the building to actually shoot people. And so I think some others think that their plan didn't necessarily go as they had made it out to be, and they had to make entry.
But here's the thing is, as we always know, bad guys always have the advantage, right? Because they know what they're going to do and they pick the time and place, and the good guys and girls are the ones having to react to that, right? And yeah, they did make an adjustment on it, but that's the point. That's a favorite tactic of terrorists too, the follow-on attacks, you know, to explode a device. People think, oh, that's the incident. No, that's just to get you out into the public so they can shoot you. All right, well, let's talk about you now. You had though made some overtures to go be chief somewhere else. Like I said, you tested, you know, as a lieutenant and stuff. So why'd you stay there? I mean, you rose up. Did you retire as assistant chief?
I retired as the chief.
As the chief?
You know, I applied at small city, Beach City, as a police chief, a lot smaller than San Bernardino. I was a lieutenant at the time, and I didn't get the job. But what's interesting, when I talked to the headhunter, he says, hey, you're only a lieutenant. What makes you think you're qualified to be the chief here? I said, well, I have a district. I have as many officers in my district as you do in this police department. And it's just a headhunter. And I said, besides, I said, I'll probably be getting promoted to captain pretty soon. And then I'll be making more than your chief, and I'll be out of your price. I'll be out of a market for you guys. You guys can't afford me. So they ultimately picked somebody else that was already a chief somewhere to come in. And they got the job, but I had the opportunity, to promote to chief, and I was the chief for the last 3 years of my career in San Bernardino.
So what was the process like? Obviously it's always good to have the hometown advantage, you know, have the home field advantage. You're already assistant chief. What was it? Was there a lot of competition though for the position?
There wasn't for that, because the chief had, retired. Well, actually had gone off on injury first. And so I was the acting chief for about a little while, for a year. And then he retired medically, and I just stayed on as the chief, and I became the interim chief. And there's kind of a funny thing is that technically post, which is overseas police standards. You know, since I was the only one that was chief, on I qualify as the chief for the purposes of post. But the city was trying to play hardball negotiations with me, and they didn't want me to get certain benefits and stuff. And I kept saying, well, you know, then go find yourself a chief. But we don't want to get anybody else, but we want you to agree to these terms. And so I refused to agree to their terms, but they weren't willing to get rid of me. So I still stayed on for the chief for another 2 years after that first initial year.
It's like a standoff.
Yeah, it was like, hey, yeah, go find, if you want me to agree to those, no, go find somebody else. Well, we don't want to get anybody else. So I was a little bit harder of a negotiator. So I got all the benefits, the pay, the, you know, everything that would come with chief, wore the 4 stars, got my executive post, which you have to be the chief, not an acting chief, but the chief for 2 years to qualify for that. And I was the chief. So I got my executive post in from California.
So. What was that movie? It was Cool Hand Luke. What we have here is a failure to communicate.
Yeah. Right.
I can't believe you wouldn't work for free for the city. Come on, Eric.
I wasn't. At some point, we got a very good pay raise. And the city manager came to me and she says, hey, my pay is tied to yours. I'll make 5% more than you. But This is like a 20% pay raise. I can't go to the city council and take this pay raise. I said, tough. I'm going to take it.
Yeah, but you'll make
more money than me. I said, well, tough to be the city manager, isn't it? So I was the highest paid city employee.
There you go.
Making more than the city manager.
Yeah, so. I care, but not that much. Well, you do what you got to do. I got to do what I got to do.
Well, and the thing is that, you know, you think that it's so important at the time to be that good partner. But when you retire, it's not like anybody calls me from the city to see how I'm doing.
Right.
You got to take care of yourself and make sure you're taken care
of. Well, when you retire, you have about a day and then it's Eric who, you know?
Exactly.
We're all expendable and replaceable.
Except you, Murph.
I'm the token hillbilly.
Yeah, you're the token. We can't get rid of you, man. So,
that's right.
Eric, so let's talk about you now. What are you doing now? So you're at a conference right now. You're doing some stuff for the FBI National Academy.
Yeah, so I went to the FBI National Academy as a student before I retired. So several years before I retired.
Was that and, were you a captain or assistant chief?
I was assistant chief at the time. I actually was on the list as a lieutenant, but it's out of the LA office, and we get only so many slots, and there's a lot of agencies in Southern California, so it's just a matter of your number coming up and then actually following up. I didn't know. I thought you just put in and didn't bug them. And then I come to find out the FBI says, well, you know, we give it to the guys who call us all the time and bug us. I thought that was the people that would piss you off and you put them on the bottom of the list. And they said, no, you got to show that you're really interested in going. But anyway, I had an opportunity to go, but when I got promoted to assistant chief, the chief tells me, hey, you know, I know you're on the list for the National Academy, but I can't afford to lose you. You know, you got
to
be here.
And how long of a commitment is it to go to the NA?
It's 10 weeks. So I'm like, hey, no problem. I want to get promoted to assistant chief. I'll forget the National Academy. So we have a position that comes available, and I assign a lieutenant. Hey, you're going to go to the National Academy. And I go tell the chief, hey, I'm sending Lieutenant so-and-so. He goes, well, don't you want to go? And this is several months in, 6 months later after I got appointed. I said, well, you told me that I couldn't go. And he says, no, you can go ahead and go. I think at that point, because he appointed me when he got appointed the chief, and maybe he felt a little uncomfortable in his role and he wanted to ensure that I was there to kind of support him. But then, so I said, okay, I'll go. But then my buddy was on the list and he was a lieutenant and he thought he had to have the National Academy to get promoted to captain. So I had another spot that opened up and I said, you know what? I'll go ahead and send you so you can go. You can take my spot. And so he went. And then finally, a few weeks later, the coordinator from the FBI called me. She says, you've been on the list for 7 years. She goes, do you want to go or not? I said, well, yeah, I want to go. She goes, okay, I'll put you in the next class. So I got to go to the National Academy.
Jeez.
Dang. So, yeah. Well, that's a good organization. I had the chance to speak at the FBI National Academy Associates meeting, their first international one they did in Toronto. And it was great time, great meeting, got to meet a lot of, and it's one of those things, man, you talk about networking and making friends, you know, all over the world. So so is that the only thing you're doing or are you doing anything else other than?
No, so, you know, my partner, so we hired a lot of people. And when we, at our department, you know, we had our own internal background investigators. And then we would, because we had so much recruitment going on that we would hire outside background investigative companies. And we really, from that, my partner and I kind of saw a lack of quality, so to speak, and in both senses. So we said, hey, when we retire, that's something that we really need to do. Plus, you know, we had outsourced some of our personnel investigations, or the HR department had. We did them all in-house if we, you know, an RIA. But even there, the quality just, we didn't think the quality was there. So about a year before I retired, we kind of got all our licensing in place and we said, hey, we're going to start up our own business when we retire. And so we got all the licensing in place, like a PI license and a security license to do operate security company as well. And so right when I retired, we were able to transition into our company. And we've grown it quite a bit just in the 2 years that I've been retired. Actually, I'm about a week short of, or a couple of days short of 2 years in retirement. And actually, next month I'll be retired 2 years, and we've grown it to a pretty good size company now. We've got about, all together with everything, we've got about 60 employees, and we're growing like gangbusters.
And you didn't think this experience managing civilians was going to come to benefit you?
Exactly. And you know the funny thing is that both my partner and I, we did 30 years, and because we wanted to make sure that we maxed out our pensions, mm-hmm. and that we wouldn't have to rely on any income from the business, in the beginning, because you need to keep reinvesting into the company as you grow any of the profits. And but we always also talk about, you know, as we get into this, if we become successful, are we ever going to look back and say, man, we should have retired 5 years earlier, you know, because we'd have been making that much money that much sooner. But we're actually getting to that conversation right now. But the but it's a good business to be in. It's a growth industry. A lot of departments are outsourcing their background investigations because you just look at, if you have an internal person that's an investigator and they're making in California, you know, $65, $75 an hour, and they're taking, you know, 3, 4, 5 months to complete it. I mean, they're not working continuously on it, but the feedback we've gotten from some of the agencies is that their internal investigators are spending 40, 50, 60 hours at that cost. And we're coming in at a fraction of that to get it done for them a lot cheaper and faster, which with the competition to hire police officers, you know, you have to be the first one. People don't apply generally for just one department. They're applying at five. And if you can get to the point where you can offer them a conditional job offer, give them a conditional job offer, you're going to get them first. And so it's a race to that conditional job offer.
Man, so you're staying busy.
We are staying pretty busy. My wife says I work more now than I ever did as a chief.
Mine says the same thing.
Yeah, and your wife's going, Eric, who? You live here? You know.
Exactly.
Hey, but dude, I got to tell you this. So we got to bring this to a close because we've kept you long. This is great stuff because we planned on going around 90 minutes, maybe just a little bit past that. But the story, there's just so many lessons to learn out of this. So, so first of all, hey, this is us saluting you, saying thank you. I mean, it's a great thing. But for people, if you're cops and you're out there and you're listening to this stuff, what's the name of your company? Where can they find you?
Palicon Group, Palicon. And everyone asks us, where's that name come from? And
somebody was drunk and they misspelled Pelican Group and it became Palicon Group.
Well, what's funny is that we wanted to brand our company that there's no confusion with any other companies. So we'd come up with a name and then we'd get on the internet and Google it. And sure enough, there's somebody named that, right? And all the cops always come up with like, some Greek warrior name or something like that for their company. And obviously we wanted to stay away from that. And so finally my partner and his wife were just kind of playing around with arranging words. And he says, what do you think about Palicon Group? And we Googled it and we're like, man, there is nobody with that. So everybody asks us, hey, what's it mean? And I say, nothing. We just made the word up. So,
well, it's very unique.
Yeah.
All right, so that's where they can find you at. And hey, look, I got to tell you that it was great. So meeting your niece, meeting your brother, you guys have got a history of service. So we thank you for
Absolutely.
That, man, and appreciate you as the chief, 4 stars, spending your time with just little old us here, man.
That's been an honor to have you on the show. Yeah.
I enjoyed. You know, obviously we know your history, Murph, and you know. That was a great story. I mean, you know, you're interviewing me, but I got to say, pass on that you had, a stellar career and a history that everybody wished they could have and be built into a TV series, right?
Well, thank you very much, Eric. But truly, it's been an honor to have you on here. And you've got a family legacy there to be extremely proud of in California. So God bless you and your family, brother.
Great. All right. Thank you.
Hang tight. You guys don't go anywhere. Everybody else, stay tuned for the debrief. Man, I just, You know, I remember that day. I actually did some analysis, news analysis about it. We talked about the use of social media, how they scrubbed their devices, the ability to track devices. But Eric's insight, you know, and what these folks went through. But it just shows you the true nature of sheepdogs, Murph. Everybody, some people may not have done it for the right reason, but when shit like this happens, everybody wants to get the bad guy, the bad girl. Everybody wants to get them.
Yeah.
And they had 300 cops. Oh my God.
Talk about an uncoordinated response. You know, and that's the thing about public service. They want to serve, they want to do the right thing. They want to get on the excitement. I mean, that, to be honest with you, that's part of it, but it just creates so many issues out there that evidence is going to fall through the cracks. Very important aspects of any investigation in establishing the elements of a crime can fall through the cracks because you don't have that coordinated response. But it also is a demonstration of the lengths that terrorists will go to attack our country, and the fact that they left that backpack inside that center with the intention of, once the first responders responded to take care of the injured, they were going to blow up a bomb in there. And just thank God, by the grace of God, that bomb did not go off and saved who knows how many more people.
Well, a common tactic, and I think that was it too, or it may have been too, they hoped that the bomb would go off and make people run out the door so they could shoot them. Mm-hmm. But the thing is, anytime you start putting explosives into this, that's a favorite tactic of terrorist groups like ISIS, ISIL, whatever you want to call them, yep. Al-Qaeda. You have the initial bomb, people show up, then they have the follow-on attacks. We've seen those at the embassies, Nairobi, Kenya, places like that. So, yeah, just think about the sheer impact. You had 14 people killed, a massive crime scene, 27 wounded. And they had good coordination, too, with the FBI, with all of their federal partners, mm-hmm. with their state and local partners. Mm-hmm. The fact that they got them and stopped them as soon as they did, considering the way they were dressed,
right,
considering the things that they did. Again, this is us saluting you, Eric. And you see the things he's doing now. You know, they're trying to do, he's got a good business going, doing background checks, making things better, making sure we hire the right kind of people. That's always important in this profession of ours we call law enforcement. So, again, us saluting you. I don't know why I salute. Nobody can see me doing this, but I'm doing it just out of habit. I'm saluting out of it, right? But, hey, this is us saluting you. And, guys, as the follow-on to our 9/11 episode with Rick Prado, I mean, these were serious discussions we wanted to have with you folks. Just, you know, we have fun in a lot of the others. Some of these are fun. Kevin Holtree was fun in some ways. It was gut-wrenching in others when you hear about what he went through. Yeah. But these I think, are things we need to keep in mind as we talk about safety and security and who are the good men and women out there. As they say, people sleep peacefully in their bed at nights because rough men and now women stand ready to do violence on their behalf. If you're a sheepdog, you got to be ready to do violence. Unfortunately, that's the way it is. But we salute those folks that are out there on the front lines doing it.
And by listening to Game of Crimes, if you're a sheep, at least you're learning what some of the threats are and what the sheepdogs are willing to do to protect us all. So thank you so much for joining us here on Game of Crimes. We love everything we do. We love the fact that you give us this opportunity.
Yeah. So guys, so thanks again. So, you know, make sure, head on over to Apple, Spotify, hit those 5 stars, head on over to gameofcrimespodcast.com for more information about the show. Also follow us on social media at Game of Crimes on Twitter, Game of Crimes Podcast on Facebook and the Instagram, but also go to Patreon, patreon.com/gameofcrimes. Support us however you see fit, but we got a lot of good content there. And also make sure you join our fans page, Game of Crimes fans. Type that into Facebook. Our favorite mafia queen, Sandy Salvato, the Iron Fist with the Velvet Glove, will allow you inside. And that's where we'll have the fun. These episodes aren't designed to be fun. They're funny in some areas, but we have fun in a lot of that. So we want to thank you guys. Again, as always, once again for playing, as you saw in this episode too, the biggest, baddest, most dangerous game of all, the Game of Crimes.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today.
Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.